Okay, well, we're 5 minutes in, so I may as well start. So the question tonight was, how scientific is socialism? It's a question that has been asked before. We talk about the socialist case as an evidence-based theory, as distinct from a moral or religious creed, but it can't be a scientific theory in the strictest definition of the term. So to what extent are we entitled to call ourselves scientific? Okay, so my thoughts on this are as follows. So I've often wondered about what it exactly means to be scientific. And one of the most, I thought, insightful things anyone's ever said to me was my oldest son, who actually, in point of fact, studied rocket science. And what he said to me was, scientist isn't an honorific title like Sir or Lord. It's a description of activity. If you do something in a scientific way, you're a scientist. So, I certainly never used to look at the world in a scientific way. I've got to admit, when I was in my teens in particular, I believed all sorts of stuff. I believed in astrology and astral projection and Velikovsky's ideas of the Earth reversing its rotation and von Daniken's idea of gods being astronauts. When I say believe might not be quite the right word. To me, the world was a kind of marvelous and miraculous place, and you know, anything seemed possible as far as I knew. Someone had written a book, a wonderful book, about Snowball Earth, and I thought, well, if that's true, if that can be true, why can't all these other things be true as well? So I read all kinds of wonderful, fantastic theories and swallowed the arguments pretty much uncritically. And that was because I didn't really know how to think critically. I didn't know the right questions to ask. I'd never heard of Occam's razor or Carl Sagan's famous axiom that extraordinary arguments require extraordinary evidence. And the fact that someone would actually go to the trouble of writing a whole book purely for commercial profit and knowing it to be completely false didn't occur to me. I just assumed that people knew what they were talking about. Now, one of my favourite characters in Douglas Adams' books that some of you will have read is a character called the Electric Monk. Now, the Electric Monk is an android who's designed to be popular with humans because he is instantly convinced in a kind of revelatory, slap himself on the forehead kind of way by anything you say to him. So while you're in the company of the Electric Monk, he gapes at your brilliance and hangs on your every word as if you're a divine guru. This is a typical of Douglas Adams' comedy. No wonder the Electric Monk was popular with humans. Now, I wouldn't say I was quite as bad as the Electric Monk. I wasn't sort of wall-to-wall gullible, if you like. I did realise that not everything I heard or read could be true, because some things contradicted other things, so some of it had to be false. The problem was I just really had no idea how to distinguish which was which. If I could point to a single memorable moment when my perception changed, I think it would have to be the 26th of November, 1977. What earth-shattering event happened on that date? Can you imagine? Well, according to the Radio Times archive, that was the date that the BBC aired an episode of the science programme Horizon, which some of you might remember, looked at the ideas, or I should say, comprehensively demolished the ideas and arguments of Erich von Daniken. They did the same thing a few years later with Graham Hancock. Anyway, what stands out in my memory was von Daniken's argument that the ancient designs marked on the ground in Peru's Nazca Plains might have been runways and taxiing bays for alien spacecraft. So in his book, Chariots of the Gods, von Daniken had compared an aerial picture of the designs on the Nazca Plains with an aerial picture of runways and taxiing aircraft bays, and, you know, amazingly, they look very similar. Now, Horizon disposed of this argument with a very simple tactic of having a film extra walk along one of these so-called runways on camera, and you could see it, you could see immediately that this supposed spacecraft runway was actually only about the width of the man's shoes. Now, I remember laughing out loud when I watched this. I wasn't really laughing at von Daniken so much. I was laughing at myself to some extent. But also, there was a kind of strange delight at the pleasure of seeing such a silly argument completely destroyed by solid evidence. And when I watched Horizon do that, I thought, if they can do it, maybe I can do it as well. Now, by coincidence, just the other day, I was watching something on... I was watching a documentary, an American documentary, and the documentary was proposing that the survivors from the fall of Carthage, which was in the Punic Wars, about 200 BC or something like that, they didn't just disappear. They actually sailed all the way to Brazil, across the Atlantic, and started a new civilization. Okay, that's a bit of a tall, far-fetched proposition right there, that they could have sailed across the Atlantic. So the documentary starts with this rather eccentric archaeologist who simply insists that it must be so. He doesn't give a reason. He wants it to be so. He says they can't have gone nowhere. They must have gone somewhere. Therefore, they could have gone to Brazil. So he sets off on a quest to find the proof. And as the documentary unfolds, it's quite clear that almost anything will do as proof. So the dodgy premises and the bogus conclusions just pile up on top of each other, and it all goes past you at such a breathless pace that a normal sort of you're an average viewer would just not even have the time to pause and go, wait, what was that? How does that make sense? Anyway, this time, unlike years ago, I wasn't fooled for a minute. I think the Socialist Party has helped me a lot to think scientifically. Socialists are generally pretty good at this sort of thing. They're good at thinking scientifically about things, in the sense of using logical, evidence-based reasoning. I mean, we still argue and disagree with each other. There's an argument going on at the moment about coronavirus. There's been quite a few arguments about that. The one at the moment is, did it escape by accident from a Wuhan lab? But what I noticed about the discussion, whichever position is being taken, the sort of scientific method is being followed. The rules are being followed. Evidence is being cited and arguments are based on it. Then counter-evidence and then counter-arguments. But is that really science or is that just common sense? We sometimes use the term scientific socialism, which Engels first used in... the short work, Socialism, Utopian and Scientific. But he was using the term in opposition to the utopian idea that you could, you know, conjure perfect societies, as it were, fully formed out of thin air and then sort of plonk them on human society anytime you liked. To contrast with that, Marx and Engels would emphasise historical context and contingency, the idea that, you know, what was possible tomorrow depends very much or entirely on the social conditions that prevail today. You can't just rely on idealistic notions in your head. But I still don't know if I would call that scientific. Again, it seems to me like a common sense statement that whatever your journey is, you have to start from where you are, not where you'd like to be. Now, there is actually, I don't know if anybody's looked, on our audio index on the website, that now there's a recorded talk on the pre-1980s page called Is Marxism a Science? This was given by somebody that some of you may remember. It was a bit before my time, Alison Waters. It's a really good talk. I do recommend it. There is a bit where she turns away from the camera and from the microphone to write something on the board and you can't hear. But apart from that, it's really good. Anyway, so she explores the question, what do we mean by scientific? And she starts with a discussion of the 1930s Vienna School of Logical Positivists, who, now they said that they decided that a statement is scientifically meaningful if it can be verified by direct observation or derived somehow from that. Pretty soon they ran into trouble with this word verified. It quickly became quite problematic. So, for example, you know, you might see a mirage with by direct observation, but that doesn't make it real. So then the talk went on to look in some depth at the ideas of Karl Popper, who did the opposite of the logical positivists and said that a statement was only scientifically meaningful if it could be falsified, i.e. that it was testable in some way. So in the one view, science was anything that could be verified. In the other, it was anything that could be falsified. Now, I know that some socialists hate Karl Popper, but he did have a point here. In science, you can't ultimately verify or prove anything is and always will be true, because that would require literally an infinity of tests. But you can show that something is false with just one test. Now, the speaker at this point seemed to not quite grasp this, because she said that if an apple fell off a tree and went upwards instead of downwards, this would not necessarily falsify Newton's theory of gravity. Well, yes, it would. That's exactly what it would do. That's why gravity is a real theory, because it's testable, there are falsifiability criteria. Now, now the reason why some socialists hate Popper is because Popper hated socialists, and he was particularly vehement against Hegel and Marx, who he regarded as historical determinists, essentially, who sort of constructed laws of history that couldn't be falsified. So according to Popper, history wasn't science. Now, it seems to me that when you're talking about the humanities generally, or what are called the social sciences, a big problem why they can't be really regarded as sciences to me is is that you can't, or at least it would be highly unethical, to conduct experiments in controlled conditions. So, for instance, somewhat counterintuitively, obesity is strongly correlated with low income. But are people fat because they're poor, or are they poor because they're fat, or are the two conditions caused by some third factor? We can weigh the evidence, we can make a best guess, but there's no socially acceptable way to test this. The way that you might do with, say, an algorithm or experiments on mice in a laboratory. And that's why I think you can't call the socialist case scientific in rigid terms, because we can't prove our case, on a computer. And then there is the questionable predictive capability of some disciplines and the lack of falsifiability in others, for example, psychology. As one example, but then again, by those definitions, you could argue that quantum theory and cosmological ideas about the multiverse are not science either. The speaker, Alison, asked an interesting question. She said, why did people want to claim that history or any other humanities discipline was a science in the first place? What was so great about doing that? Because 19th century science and 20th century was and continues to be seen as the paradigm, she said, of human inquiry. So, you know, in the sense of an intellectually rigorous, cross-cultural benchmark. And so it was natural for every discipline to want to join that kind of quite exclusive club and get a taste of that prestige, so ran the argument. It made me wonder whether at some kind of level we're doing that too, brandishing this phrase scientific. These things arguably are not scientific, or else they are science, but they're of a different sort with different definitions. In other words, you could almost say that science is whatever you say it is. So the question, what is science, what is scientific, may become unanswerable. The talk concludes, maybe a bit surprisingly, that there's not much actually to be gained by calling Marxism scientific, or claiming that the materialist conception of history is scientific, simply because of the definition problem. It just begs too many questions about what do you mean by scientific. What we do today, we follow a rational, evidence-based approach, which is about all you can say that we do that's scientific. But you could just say that about, you could say that about a lot of organisations, even a lot of political ones, I would say. So should we really be using the term scientific socialism at all these days? And my answer is that I don't know. So what do you think? Are we scientific? Or should we stop saying so?
That's fascinating, Paddy. Thanks very much indeed. It seems to me there's nothing more to be said.
Well, I said I don't know, so I think there's a bit more to add.
No, extremely interesting. Thank you, though. Can I mention, if nobody else is talking, go back to Eric von Daniken, Chariot of the Gods. I first came across this in the early 70s. I remember reading the book. I read the book because at the time I was a tutor in a University Hall of Residence. One of my fellow tutors, who was a scientist, was a chemical engineer, I remember, recommended I read it. And he said, I remember him saying, I've every reason to believe that it's true.
Yes, I remember. I remember when I was studying archaeology briefly, and we were having a lecture on Australopithecus. And for some reason, I don't know why, the devil made me do it, I think. But the lecturer asked for questions, and I put my hand up and asked what she thought of Eric von Daniken, and she just gave me such a withering look.
Some old timers may remember that the old Western socialist had as its description underneath the title. That is the, the Journal of the World Socialist Party of the United States, Journal of Scientific Socialism. Don't know if there must be some people here who remember that.
I think Dougie, you just put your cue in the speaking. Are we using the speaking cue? Should we use the speaking cue? Why not? Go on then, Dougie.
Yeah. I mean, we all have things in the past that are a bit silly. I mean, I remember reading Lyle Watson books or whatever, and he said you can sharpen razor blades. You won't ever have to buy a razor blade again if you make yourself a pyramid. I remember as a child, I think I was only about 15 or 16 or whatever, I tried doing that. Of course, it was a lot of nonsense. But he also said things like, if you stand on grass, the other grass faints or whatever, or if you pull a flower off a plant or whatever, the other plants know about it. So it was all nonsense, really. But, I mean, it was one of the things I fell for when I was younger, right? But I've got a scientific background in chemistry, right? So, I mean, I came across the party when I was at university, and the idea has appealed to me, right? And I haven't looked back, or I haven't looked forward, no matter what, depending on your point of view. So, yeah, I mean, we all have things in the past that we believe that weren't true, right?
Okay, Mike Brown?
Yeah, can you hear me? Just checking the volume.
Yeah.
Okay, yes, he was a Howard. Yes, that's one of the reasons why I joined the Socialist Party of Great Britain, because I read quite a few of the Western socialists, and they were always quite well-written articles. Very little speculation or anything like that in them. They're always they tried to be scientific, and they did a good job. But I think what I learned when I was about 16 or something, in Ireland, they really brainwashed you. In the 50s and 60s, and you had to believe in all these. These days we would call very strange religious ideas. You had this question, who made the God? And I asked that, well, who made God? And I was told to shut up. But I do remember the very vaguely ones, the South American Van Daniken thing. But see, I read a lot of things about archaeology, and there's things that in the late 60s, early 70s, there was a lot of books about Stonehenge and all these astronomical temples or examples that were put out. And I used to read those because I was interested in astronomy and tried to figure out what was going on, or, you know, what they meant. But there was, I still don't know what was it, the Stonehenge, the English one, the Stonehenge thing, what was it built for, what is it, the current area is, it looks like it's the winter solstice orientation. But yeah, I always found it quite interesting to read these funny books, because I read a book about the guy, the Venus guy. Venus came out of Jupiter or something. Velosky, I think his name was. But I read his the book about him, pointing out all the errors in it, astronomical, that rubbish he was coming out with, before I read the book. So yeah, I had a long history of basically based on evidence, scientific evidence. One of the books I found very good, though, in early 70s, was, well, you won't believe it, but Timothy Leary's Politics of Ecstasy. Because I read that, and I found it was a very good description of what acid was doing. Really, really good scientific evidence for that. And that was, you know, taking acid at the time, I could know what I knew I was talking about. But I did read quite a lot of books, and once I was able to go to the public libraries, there was quite a few censors, you know, books that were censored, but I caught up with them when I came to England. In Ireland, in those times, they were censoring everything. I remember knowing about the evolutionary theory of Charles Darwin. And that convinced me of what you had to do, get the evidence, make sense of it. I remember going to some meetings run by Jesuits, and they were sort of, couldn't ask, he couldn't answer any questions about Darwin. They were always going off the point on it. Anyway, enough for me. But thanks for that, Paddy. Really hearing some of that. I never heard that Cartridge Brazil book. I don't know that one. But there was quite a lot of books. They're very good to read to find out what's wrong with them.
Okay, thank you. Brian Johnson.
Yeah, nice summary, Paddy. You've got to be honest there. I think what you failed to point out was there's the scientific method, and it's the Marxian method. Two totally different methods. Let me just get up scientific method now. According to Wikipedia, the scientific method is an empirical method of acquiring knowledge that has characterized the development of science since at least the 17th century. It involves careful observation, applying rigorous skepticism about what is observed, given that cognitive assumptions can distort how one interprets the observation. It involves formulating hypotheses via induction, based on such observations, experimental and measurement-based testing of deductions drawn from the hypothesis and refinement or elimination. I think it's something else as well. Let me just see if I can bring the rest of it up.
I hope you're not going to read all of it out.
No, I won't then. No, I won't. You know, what I will do then, contrast that against the Marxist method. The Marxist method is far more simpler. Right. First of all, you got the class struggle. Then you got the economics, which boils down to profit, value, price, and profit. Right. And then you got the social evolution, and it's a mixture of them three to come to a conclusion and an analysis of what's occurred in society, what's occurred in the past, right, what's occurred in now, and what could possibly occur in the future. That's the two different things. Some would say that the Marxian method is too subjective, and others would say that the scientific method itself is too objective, and that one doesn't take into account the other sufficiently enough to reach a whole analysis on what's occurring within society. But there you go, anyway.
Okay, all right, thank you for that. Mike Foster.
Yeah, thanks for that. Yeah, really interesting introduction, also the discussion so far. Thought that popped into my head was that it's quite easy to be lazy about sort of following the scientific method. If you've got a point to make, it's quite easy to find, you know, evidence for it by picking a quote or picking a statistic and using it to reinforce what you're saying. And, you know, by doing that, assuming that you're acting scientifically. But, you know, of course, you can't just pick one quote or one statistic. You have to weigh that up on its own merits and compare that with other ones. And, you know, you could probably find something equally plausible that, you know, that was that confirmed the opposite of the view you're trying to make. So, yeah, it takes quite a lot of effort to analyze something in a strict scientific way. And I think that always has to be backed up by, you know, sort of rational argument. I sort of came to, or my socialist views were sort of reinforced from a sort of philosophical angle. So, you know, with that, you judge the how rational an argument is. And of course, you know, the scientific method has got sort of close links to that. But yeah, I suppose my point was that philosophy can be a useful framework as well as, I'm not saying it contradicts it, but as well as the scientific viewpoint. And yeah, the sort of philosophical way of looking at socialism, that's sort of a quite a big way of how I see it. But I think whatever framework we use, you know, if we try and adhere to a scientific method, or it really sort of reinforces, or we use it to reinforce our own sort of emotional response to capitalism. I think our emotional response, which, you know, is harder to analyze in a scientific way, I think that motivates a lot of our views as much as how rigorous we think we've analyzed them. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually, something that I didn't really think about, but how, as you say, how we can sort of cherry pick our evidence and you know, sort of prove our own arguments to our own satisfaction. Yeah, I mean, we need to look at cognitive biases here, don't we? Particularly, we need to be particularly aware of things like confirmation bias, because insofar as we're prey to unrecognized cognitive biases, we're not being scientific. You know, we are being completely subjective. We always need to be able to ask ourselves, am I right in saying this, or could I be wrong? Is there some way that I could? Is there some evidence that says I'm wrong? Howard.
There's a linguistic angle to this, I think, an important one. The party has saddled itself with various items of vocabulary, which over the years has probably done it more harm than good. I mean, arguably, one of those is the word socialism itself. You know, we all know it's got so many different meanings for so many different people. All right, it enables us to explain what we mean, but trouble is we don't often get the chance. Working class is another one. You know, most people, if you say, talk about working class, a different picture comes to their mind than comes to ours. And you know, it makes explaining our case more difficult. And, you know, there have been disputes in the party over the years as to whether we should use different terminology. Won't go into detail about these, but, you know, a lot of us will know about that. And, I mean, I think it's fortuitously good that, you know, we haven't followed the WSP US in using this word scientific when talking about our journal or our arguments. I mean, I don't think they do it anymore because, you know, they haven't got the journal they had. They've got a new journal now, but presumably it doesn't say Journal of Scientific Socialism. You know, it wouldn't be sort of very effective if it did. And I suppose a good test for this is who in giving a talk, giving some kind of presentation on socialism, putting the socialist case, would end the talk by saying, and what I've said is scientific. Wouldn't do it, would we? Because, you know, it's not the way the word is normally used in everyday language. And I think, you know, we've got to bear that in mind when we're putting the case generally. Use the language, use the terminology that the people listening to us are likely to understand and make sense of.
Yeah, I think also there's this term scientific that I sort of suggested that it was regarded as a bit of a kind of badge of honour, you know, a kind of prestigious title to award yourself, and I wondered if sometimes we were doing that for that very reason, to give ourselves a little bit more kind of intellectual gravitas or something. But I mean, it can work the other way, can't it? Because a lot of people are quite scared of science, and they're quite put off by it. And as soon as you start bandying terms like that around, you know, you could potentially put some people off. Janet, I think you'll have to unmute. Oh, there you go.
I'm here. I'm sorry. I can't get to the unmute button quickly enough. I was going to say that I thought that the word I don't think I've ever used the word scientific in relation to our case, because I feel that it's a bit highfalutin, really. I think that to be scientific, you have to be one of this fraternity where all their work is subject to peer review. And so it can be followed back and tested, and anything they say or anything they publish is subjected to that. And also, I think this vaccine stuff just recently has sort of shown that they have done this immense amount of research into the vaccine, and then they try it out on 20,000 people, I don't know what the figures are, but something like that, to see and calculate what the results are and what the any repercussions might be, and so on and so on. And that is scientific. We can't do that with our arguments, really. We can only give many, many great examples, but it is, as somebody said, subjective. And I think also, has anybody actually gone through Capital and followed through Marx's workings out? I don't know that anybody apart from Adam would have done that. And I don't know whether he was always correct either. He may be well wrong. But overall, I think his ideas were right and were good. That doesn't mean that they're going to stand up to sort of great examination. But I don't think, in my feelings, it doesn't really matter, because there are so many other reasons for socialism, or whatever it's chosen to be called, that it doesn't matter that we can't lay the word scientific. And I think it would be a bit grandiose to do that. Thank you.
This question Janet asked about has anybody ever worked out Marx's workings? I think Steve Finch knows about this more than I do, but I've heard him talking about whole bunches of people in, I think, the ICC. People like that have devoted a lot of time to doing exactly that, sitting there with three volumes of Capital and a calculator and working it all out. So I think there have been kind of train spotters who've done that.
Apparently, Comrade Balmer from Manchester branch knows of a slight error due to some sort of mathematical misunderstanding on my part. but I don't know any more than that about it. I think the more important thing is the. Am I sounding terrible?
Hello.
No, you're all right.
I think the more important part, rather than the because the thing is, Marx doesn't actually use that much. In fact, in his general theory, he doesn't put numbers on things, except as his own mathematical argument, and it doesn't even say. Well, I'm not saying more than that, but the basis of his argument works. The argument of surplus value, and this is where it is important to know these things. As workers, it's important to know that capitalism, because of the way that capital works, is never going to be so, and it's always going to work against our economic interests. And that's the proof of Marx. Not whether every single bloody calculation's correct. But the underlying arguments of increased use of technology leading to reductions in generally wages, and increases in technology leading to instability both for us and for the capitalists. But let's face it, we're not bothered about them because what they're doing is the advance of capital is destroying smaller and smaller smaller capitals, so that you end up with this concentration of wealth. I mentioned this to you today, Paddy. I think I prefer this empirical analysis, the word empirical rather than scientific. That's me.
Okay, I think it's Brian next.
Yeah, I think it's pretty obvious, you know, that it's very hard to measure using the Marxian method, you know, like Steve pointed out in regards to calculations. And that said, if it's true, the ICC are wandering up the garden path, and that's it. I've noticed, though, between the two methods, the scientific method and the Marxian method, use patterns. They both use patterns, right? And they also use processes as well, right? To explain the patterns, how things as occur. I mean, for us, we've got the revolutionary process. You know, the revolution goes in certain ways. It's not, it's methodical, but it's not dogmatic, and it depends on the circumstances at the time, exactly how that actual process works out. But the framework of it is that it's a class struggle between different classes in different societies, and it's now boiled down to in capitalism of a class struggle between two classes, the capitalists and the workers, right? And with the patterns, you know, the patterns itself applies to the classes. If you look, you know, really carefully, you see that society regardless of the suggestions and the so-called observations that's being made, that there's multiple classes in society. You really find that in actual fact there's only two classes.
Okay, thanks. Mike Foster.
Cheers. Yeah, I think following on from what Steve and Brian were saying, I wanted to sort of add on and sort of emphasize that it's all very well and good to analyze Marx and see if what he wrote fitted in with conditions in, you know, 19th century Europe. Great stuff if that was an accurate scientific analysis of conditions at the time. But of course, we need to take into account changes since then, and double check that Marx's theories still apply now that we've got things like, you know, the welfare state, you know, that's role in the role of that in the economy, mass media, the internet, things like that, which, you know, weren't around in Marx's time. We need to obviously continually reevaluate his theories and theories connected with his, in line with changing trends, you know, technology as well. And I think sometimes, again, it's a sort of a laziness thing. It's easy enough to boil everything down to the profit motive, but that's a sort of a glib sort of 19th century sort of slogan almost. And I think, we need to sort of constantly reevaluate. Yeah, profit's the driving force, but it's not the only one in a sort of an economy that's changed since the 19th century. So my point was that we need to continually reevaluate Marx, not just rely on taking things he said and how they applied in the 19th century, because obviously there's a lot of change between then and now. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, Steve, did you want to say something?
Just to come back in about what Mike's just said. Despite this new idea of the welfare state, don't forget in the 19th century that the poor law. But I mean, it wasn't to the same extent as we've got now. But there was a poor law, and there was some sort of provision for people that were on hard times, obviously much less. But the motive for production has not changed, and it's that motive for production within capitalist social relation that drives society. And there's absolutely no question about that. I mean, you've got. Because capitalism has gone, there's one. I mean, I've not really thought this through, but there's one major way in which capitalism has changed now, relative to those, and that it's gone completely global, and that we've got this in enormous states that are involved in enormous amounts of expenditure in weaponry and such like. Now, yeah, I mean that is somewhat of a change, and that can be its own driver. I tend to agree with that, but the underlying basis for that system is still the profit motive, and it's still the exploitation of workers, whether they be on a factory floor or whether they be in an office. That's me.
Okay, thank you. Richard.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Okay, often you can't. I just want to make a really nerdy point. I just want to come in here at the moment. Just by coincidence, I've been having this debate in the last few days with an anarchist. And I think just on the matter of terminology, to call socialism scientific in the modern sense of the word, we can't do that. But Marx wasn't actually using the modern sense of the word scientific. His concept of the word that actually he used in German was Wissenschaft, and which actually means evidence-based. So he was attempting to place sort of his theory on an evidential basis as opposed to sort of utopian socialism. But I want to say that beside that, his thesis in Capital conforms to every scientific requirement for us to be able to say it is actually a scientific theory. The problem is it's a scientific theory that cannot be proven. Scientific theory does not actually have to be to qualify as a scientific theory. A theory actually has only to be provable in principle. If there are practical or ethical reasons why testing cannot take place, that doesn't actually quite disqualify it as a scientific theory. So Marx's theory in Capital is it meets all the requirements for a scientific theory, but actually because it's unproven and unprovable, because you cannot sort of conduct reasonable experiments on a society, then it's an open-ended thing. It's the actual jury is still out on Marx on the issue of the on the issue of changes. I think one thing that needs to be said about it is that Marx takes this concept of value in his theory, and he uses it. It's part of an apparatus that he uses, which allows him to explore social relationships in his own time. And those social relationships are as true today as they were in the past. So if you actually approach Marx on that basis, then he has proven or not in terms of his general thesis, he still has a huge amount to say about that's of value, about how our social relationships actually function, both in his own day and in ours. So we need to be careful about this term scientific. Marx's theory is scientific in that sense, but that doesn't mean that socialism is scientific, because his theory actually isn't proven, because there's no way to actually distinguish between all the factors that he's dealing with in the real world and actually isolate them and test them. You can't do that. So yeah, it's a scientific theory, but an unproven one.
That's a good point, isn't it? And something that one of the reasons that Popperians oppose Marx's theory, or as they understand Marx's theory, is that it's obviously you can't prove it. You can't really prove anything outside of maths. Sometimes not even inside of maths. But that's why the Popperians say, well, that's not the criteria. To prove something isn't the criteria. It's whether it can be falsified. And they argue that Marxism has been falsified. For example, Marx's idea of immiseration, that things would get worse and worse and worse and worse for the working class. And Popperians will point to historical fact that things have actually improved for workers in advanced capitalist countries anyway, and that this therefore disproves Marx in theory. But Marxist theory is not contingent on the idea of immiseration, so it wasn't a prediction anyway, as I understand it, that Marx was making. But I also, you're right as well, that what Marx, the way that he argued was, here's what my opponents say. My opponents are putting forward proposition A. If proposition A is true, then it follows that proposition B, C and D. Are propositions B, C and D also true? Let's look at the facts. No, proposition B isn't true. Proposition D isn't true, and so forth. That means that proposition A can't be correct. So this is perfectly logical reasoning. It's in the finest traditions of science. I'm agreeing with Richard. You can't test socialism in a laboratory. Its predictive power is questionable. Yes, I mean you can predict broad trends in capitalism. Arguably booms and slumps, things like that. But as I think I said before, predictive capability isn't a be all and end all definition of science any more than sort of being able to run controlled double blind experiments or any of those kind of things. So I agree with Richard. I think there is perfectly good case for saying that Marx proceeded in a scientific way, even if you can't call Marxism a scientific theory.